This is Jay Sekulow. Remembering 9/11, our guest, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani and former U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft.
Live from Washington, D.C., Jay Sekulow Live.
Where were you when the world stopped turning on that September day?
America today is on bended knee in prayer for the people whose lives were lost here, for the workers who work here, for the families who mourn. This nation stands with the good people of New York City and New Jersey and Connecticut as we mourn the loss of thousands of our citizens.
Phone lines are open for your questions right now. Call 1-800-684-3110.
Faith, hope, and love are some good things He gave us, and the greatest is love.
I can hear you!
The greatest is love.
I can hear you, the rest of the world hears you, and the people...
And now, Chief Counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice, Jay Sekulow.
It was 17 years ago that 3,000 Americans, brave Americans, gave their lives for freedom. Let me give you the time frame of what we're talking about. We're going to be joined by Mayor Rudy Giuliani from New York, of course, was the mayor of New York City at the time, and former Attorney General John Ashcroft, who was the Attorney General at the time of 9/11. But let me give you the time frame. At 8:46 a.m. Eastern Time, hijacked Flight 11 was crashed into floors 93 and 99 of the North Tower of the World Trade Center, One World Trade Center. At 9:03, just about 15 minutes later, the hijacked Flight 175 struck floors 77 and 85 of the South Tower. That was 17 minutes later. Remember, the first reports were that this was a small plane that had hit the World Trade Center building. At the time the towers were struck, between 16,400 and 18,000 people were in the World Trade Center complex. Of those, the vast majority were evacuated safely, which is still miraculous when you think about it. Remember, they were talking about having 30,000 body bags available in New York City alone. At 9:37, five hijackers crashed American Flight 90, it's Flight 77, into the Pentagon. 53 passengers and six crew were among the 125 military and civilian personnel killed on the ground. At 9:59, the South Tower collapses. At 10:03 a.m., Flight 93 collapses near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where the memorial was dedicated today with the president there. At 10:28, the flight, the North Tower collapses. On May 2, 2011, Osama bin Laden was killed in Pakistan by SEAL Team 6. Jordan, you were not only in Washington, you were a student at George Washington University. What do you remember the most?
The streets. Because at that point, by the time we were out of the classroom, so we were already in early classrooms. It was 8 a.m. classes. And the building was cleared out. It was next to the State Department. I saw Ari Fleischer was on today. He talked about how there was so much information coming in, and no one wanted to be someone who didn't get the information out. So it was unfiltered coming to the president. And then it would make it to the news. And so the news even said that the State Department had been hit. That's basically on GW's campus. So there was. But then you walked into the streets, and it was total gridlock after the rush hour. And cell phones weren't working because cell phone towers were down. This is pre-Wi-Fi calling, so you didn't have these kind of accesses. And so you couldn't make phone calls. And we were getting used to that, you know, being able to walk around and constantly communicate. So you couldn't do that. The city was on a gridlock. Ultimately, the bridges get closed out of the city and into the city. But it was a shocking moment to see that kind of gridlock. And I think for the imagery, because it's all people, then you turn on the TV and you had to... You watched this, so everyone saw this, and it's one of those moments generationally that you're not going to move past.
Yeah.
That we were talking about this morning, it's 17 years in, and we're still dedicating most of the day, most of the news covers that you see on this one attack, on one day.
Yeah. I was in the office in Norfolk, Virginia, at Regent University, and we traveled up to Richmond. That's where Jordan and I met, at Richmond, Virginia. Rodney Ross from our team got Jordan, got him out, and then we came back in, and we'll talk about that when we came back into Washington just a few days later. Our thoughts and prayers with the families of 9/11, it doesn't go away. And the battle doesn't go away either. We'll be back with more, including your phone calls at 1-800-684-3110. Back in with more in a moment.
This is a critical time for the Supreme Court and our nation. President Trump has nominated a brilliant jurist to fill the seat created by the retirement of Justice Kennedy. Judge Brett Kavanaugh is eminently qualified. He has extensive experience and a commitment to adhere to the rule of law and uphold the Constitution. Yet the radical left is pulling out all the stops to derail this nomination. That's why it's so critical to support this nominee. The American Center for Law and Justice is mobilizing on Capitol Hill, demanding Judge Kavanaugh's immediate confirmation. Stand with us on this critical fight. Sign on to our petition, calling on the U.S. Senate to confirm Judge Kavanaugh without delay. Add your name to our petition right now online, aclj.org. It's a historic move. Now the United States has moved its embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, Israel's true capital. The state of Israel and its very right to exist is a linchpin issue not only in the Middle East, but represents a critical issue to the world at large. Israel is facing unprecedented challenges. Enemies abound. ISIS, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran all pledge to wipe Israel from the face of the earth. In his new book, New York Times bestselling author Jay Sekulow presents a powerful political and historical rationale for the existence of Israel as a sovereign nation. Jerusalem, a biblical and historical case for the Jewish capital, presents clear, irrefutable evidence to remove any doubt about Israel's right to exist. And the book dispels legal myths purported by Israel's enemies. Get your copy today, Jerusalem, a Biblical and Historical Case for the Jewish Capital. Available now at Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Hey, welcome back. It is the 17th year of this since the 9/11 attacks. Over 3,000 killed, many in New York City. And we are joined by my colleague and friend and the former mayor of New York City, America's Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Mayor Giuliani, thanks for being with us today, especially today. You and I are working on other matters together now, but you take a day like this and you reflect back. Thanks for being with us. I really appreciate it.
So, well, Jay, I really appreciate talking to the audience and to you. Thank you.
So let's talk about what it was like for you that very day. I was in Norfolk, Virginia. Jordan was in Washington. And then the first notification of a plane, and the first reports were that it was a small plane that hit the North Tower, one of the towers, and it was on the news, obviously, is a big deal, but nobody had the significance of it till a few minutes later. What was it like for you as the mayor?
Same. Well, the same thing, really. I was having breakfast, finishing a breakfast, with my counsel, Dennis and Young, and with Bill Simon, who eventually ran a year later for governor of California. And Bill was a former assistant U.S. attorney of mine. And we were discussing running for governor of California, the pros and the cons of the Republican primary. And all of a sudden, one of my detectives walked in, Patty Verone. It was primary day in New York, so we were kind of getting started a little bit later than usual. And she leaned over and she said, a twin-engine plane, just like you said, a twin-engine plane hit the North Tower, and that the fire was pretty bad. So we rushed down there. I just drove that stretch going down to the ceremony, and it's eerily, it looks, you know, it reminds me every step of the way I can remember what I saw.
Yeah.
But I immediately saw a big flame, and then all of a sudden I saw another big flame, and Bernie Kerik, the police commissioner, called me and said, Mayor, a second plane has hit. Of course, that's when we knew it was a terrorist attack.
When I remember watching you when you brought so much comfort to the people of New York and frankly to the country, but the concern was, I mean, Jordan had this in Washington, was that it within a very short period of time, I went through the time frame with everybody, starting at 8:46 a.m., till the North Tower collapse at 10:28, you had all of those incidents within literally less than 2 hours. So that we know it was a very coordinated attack. How long did it take to realize the nature of the coordination? And what was the, you had first responders literally running into a building that was going to collapse.
Well, you know, the of course, they didn't know it was going to collapse at that point. The thinking was Pete Gansey was the fire chief who ran the incident. And he was extremely experienced. He was the best in New York City that we had. And his estimation, when I arrived there, I went immediately to him. And I said, Chief, what's going on? How bad is it? He said, it's terrible. He said, I think we have the rest of the day to deal with this. but there'll be nothing left of this building eventually. But he wasn't anticipating an implosion. He was anticipating the building falling down in stages. So all of a sudden, I saw this man jump out of the 101st, 102nd floor, escaping the flames. And Jay, it was like, it was a shock. I mean, I just stopped for a second, and I said, Chief, can we send helicopters up there? And he said to me, we can't. The flames are too bad. And I had this terrible feeling that I was looking at those people above the flames, and they all were going to be dead. And we were totally powerless to help them. And it was the first really terrible feeling where your stomach feels like it's going to sink. And then the rest of the day was a combination of sometimes horrible incidents like that, seeing bodies crushed, and sometimes unbelievable people coming forward, running into the building, saving people, carrying people out. It was just a total contradiction.
Yeah.
Jordan. Yeah, Mayor, the attack was generationally defining. I was, again, I was in college in D.C., a lot of friends from New York and New Jersey at GW. And this, again, for our generation, you're kind of still the mayor of New York, and this is what we remember. I mean, this it also defined going to war in Afghanistan and Iraq. Ultimately, I mean, the imagery, though, what is it like to see? I saw, you know, I thought today, I saw at the ceremony in New York, and I wonder if you noticed this too, that some of the police officers there were probably young children, probably 10 years old when this occurred, younger than me. And now they're there at the ceremony.
Yeah, go ahead, Mayor.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, the whole generation has developed, right? And I meet a lot of people, and their parents will bring the child up to me and say, you know, he wasn't here or she wasn't here on September 11th. Mayor, tell him what it's about. And I have to give like a 2 or 3 minute history lesson.
Yeah.
But the reality is, I think there's probably more intense memory of this because it's continuing. You know, here we are 17 years later. It's a pretty stark memory for those who were alive, and even for some of the younger ones, because the war is still going on. I mean, we're still fighting in Afghanistan, and we're still defending London and Paris and, to some extent, New York and our homeland. People are being killed by Islamic extremist terrorists right now. So I think President Bush was right when he said this would be a very long war, and our patience had to exceed theirs.
And by nature, they're very, I mean, we know this historically. The Islamic extremists are patient. Their patience can be intergenerational patients. But here we are 17 years later. I wanted to get your reflections on this from a foreign policy standpoint. How do you view the situation right now with the radicalization within Islam? I mean, the president has done a very effective job, and I don't want to get into politics at all, on ISIS. But there's still this, the threat of radicalization and the impact that it can have on our cities is something that I think we're still living with at a very significant level. But obviously, you're much more of an expert on this than I am. What is your sense globally?
You know, Jay, I don't know that we get to see it as much here in the United States. I think I'm right about this. I don't think this is really a terrible problem in New York, even Detroit, where there's a heavy Muslim population. I still think we have the largest, by far, segment of the community is integrated and assimilated and American. This is a big problem with our allies in England, France, Germany. I mean, those places are pretty darn tense. I was at the MEK rally with Newt Gingrich on July 1st in Paris. And the day after we finished, 4 people were arrested in Belgium who were coming there to blow it up. And it wasn't that much, it wasn't that big a news item in Paris because they're so used to it. This is terrible.
Yeah.
And they have a very radicalized, much more radicalized extremist community than we do, which may be why they have so many more attacks than we do.
You know, you do security consulting all over the globe. And I look at this globally as well, and there's new alignments in the Middle East now that we didn't have before with Israel, in alignment with, you know, in relationships with Jordan and Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and then you've got the threat of Iran. Let's talk about here you've got the jihadists here. Bin Laden was, of course, this was an al-Qaeda attack. Where do you see those groups? If you look at al-Qaeda, ISIS, the Iranians that are continuing, the regime continuing to fund terror groups, how do you see that coming together? How do you see that now, 17 years later?
Well, I don't want to say this in any way to create a, I'm not superstitious, but maybe I am. I think we're pretty darn safe here. I really do. I think this is, it could change easily. And I think, and I know you and I both represent him, so they may think that, but I think President Trump has made us safer and his administration. I think they focused on this more singularly than we were for a few years. But I do think they are completely organized in their purpose, so that even though there are natural divisions between Iranian terrorists and, let's say, Al-Qaeda, Sunni, Shia, they're not fighting with each other right now, except maybe in Syria a bit, in Yemen. They want to bring us down, and then they're going to figure, then they'll probably go to war with each other.
Yeah.
So they have a singular purpose. Iran is the most dangerous because it's a nation state. Even though Al-Qaeda, whatever exists of it, ISIS, is very violent, maybe more violent, Iran is the real danger because this is a nation state that is on the way to being nuclear, and they're supporting terrorism more than anyone else.
Well, let me say this, Mayor. We're getting people from Facebook are posting messages, and a lot of them are thanking you for your service to the country, especially during that time. Gret on Facebook said Mayor Giuliano was a hero to us all that day, and that is very true. You were you and the President Bush at the time were a very calming influence, very steady hands and leadership, and I appreciated your leadership then, and I've appreciated our friendship over the years and decades. Since, but and of course, an honor to work with you now. But Mayor, thanks for being with us on this important day. Thank you so much,
Gordon. Jay, thank you very much, and God bless everybody.
Thank you, Mayor Rudy Giuliani. And that's where we're going to focus on this on the broadcast today. There's a lot of other news items going on. I understand that. But we're focusing on this. After the break, we're going to be joined by the former Attorney General of the United States, John Ashcroft, and his experience on 9/11. Obviously, it had completely shifted. People forget that, Jordan. He had to shift the Fire Department of Justice and FBI into counterintelligence.
That was a domestic election. I mean, we're used to these foreign policy issues now dominating a lot of political. With ISIS, Iran, nuclear Iran. These were not a topic coming up in the 2000 election. It was mostly education and economic issues. And suddenly the entire Bush administration shifts to this war strategy. I mean, you go to war almost immediately and then also ultimately two wars.
And the counterintelligence.
And a new legal system had to be set up
exactly.
To deal with these terrorists.
All right, we're going to take your calls on this, too, if you want to talk to John Ashcroft or us. Our team will be joining us in the second half hour. 1-800-684-3110, John Ashcroft coming up.
It's a historic move. Now the United States has moved its embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, Israel's true capital. The state of Israel and its very right to exist is a linchpin issue not only in the Middle East, but represents a critical issue to the world at large. Israel is facing unprecedented challenges. Enemies abound. ISIS, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran all pledge to wipe Israel from the face of the earth. In his new book, New York Times bestselling author Jay Sekulow presents a powerful political and historical rationale for the existence of Israel as a sovereign nation. Jerusalem, a biblical and historical case for the Jewish capital, presents clear, irrefutable evidence to remove any doubt about Israel's right to exist. And the book dispels legal myths purported by Israel's enemies. Get your copy today, Jerusalem, a Biblical and Historical Case for the Jewish Capital. Available now at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. This is a critical time for the Supreme Court and our nation. President Trump has nominated a brilliant jurist to fill the seat created by the retirement of Justice Kennedy. Judge Brett Kavanaugh is eminently qualified. He has extensive experience and a commitment to adhere to the rule of law and uphold the Constitution. Yet the radical left is pulling out all the stops to derail this nomination. That's why it's so critical to support this nominee. The American Center for Law and Justice is mobilizing on Capitol Hill, demanding Judge Kavanaugh's immediate confirmation. Stand with us on this critical fight. Sign on to our petition, calling on the U.S. Senate to confirm Judge Kavanaugh without delay. Add your name to our petition right now online, aclj.org.
Well, 17 years ago, it started at 8:46 a.m. with a hijacked Flight 11 crashed into the North Tower. A 9:03 hijacked Flight 175 struck the South Tower. That was 17 minutes later. At 9:37 a.m., just 33 minutes after that, five hijackers crashed American Airlines Flight 77 into the Pentagon. And then at 6:59 a.m., the South Tower collapses. 10:03, just 4 minutes later, Flight 93 crashes in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. The president was there today. At 10:28, the North Tower collapses. And then on May 2nd, 2011, Osama bin Laden is killed. Joining us now is former Attorney General of the United States, John Ashcroft, who was the Attorney General of the United States at the time of 9/11, a good friend of ours, distinguished professor of law at Regent University, and a fellow at our Law and Justice Institute at Regent. General Ashcroft, thanks for being with us today. I wanted to get your reflection because people are, it's interesting that for some reason, and we're getting this a lot right now in our audience, that this year's hit people harder than other years. And I know it hits hard for every year for all of us, but some years harder than others. And maybe it was Jordan said that the Shanksville Monument was put up. Can you recount for our audience what you were the Attorney General of the United States at that time, where you were and how it was communicated to you that we were under attack?
Well, Jay, I was part of the president's effort to increase literacy among young people. So he had asked members of the cabinet to go around the country reading to young people. The president himself was in Florida. I was on a plane on my way to Milwaukee, somewhere, you know, mid-Michigan, before we would descend across the lake into Milwaukee in the small airplane, when the pilot looked back and said, General Ashcroft, would you pick up the phone to the command center? And so I got on the phone to the command center and learned of the unfolding attack. And it was certainly not something anticipated in any respect. It was shocking. I turned to the folks who were with me on the airplane and said, the world will never be the same. And unfortunately, the world is not the same. It's a much more dangerous place than it was in pre-9/11 days.
General, what was the how long did it take? I mean, this because when I just went through the timeline. It happened so quickly. I mean, you had all of these attacks and the towers falling literally within 2 hours of each other, not even. How long did it take to know the nature of the attack? And then I want you to walk through kind of the right after what was the plan. But was it known quickly among the administration cabinet officers of who was responsible for this? Or was there any sense of that? Or how did that come down?
Well, in the first day, I think we had pretty much figured out who the people were on these planes who took the plane. And once we had the identities of these individuals, it became clear that they fit a profile of extremists whose beliefs and activities had been directed to injure the United States overseas. And this is the first time that this had kind of crossed the ocean, that it had been a part of our threat here. And that was a distinguishing characteristic. But once we identified the individuals, and that was from manifests and other things on the planes. And you remember, some of the attacks were made in ways that there was communication between the airplanes and people on the ground. I know the Solicitor General of the United States, yes, Ted Olson, his wife was on the plane. She called him on the phone twice as the plane was being directed into the Pentagon. So information was being fed back in sort of ways that were only available as a result of like cell phone technology.
Yep.
But our technology is far different now than it was then. But so we were able to learn pretty early what we were up against, and that molded and shaped what our response would be over the next couple of weeks and couple of years, as a matter of fact.
Yep. I do remember talking to Ted Olson about the two calls he had with Barbara. That was heart-wrenching. I think that the phone from his desk, it was Solicitor General then under you. One of the main museums in Washington, maybe the Smithsonian. But go ahead, Jordan.
Yeah, General Ashcroft, I was talking about, I wanted to go back to the time that how much the world has changed since this. You mentioned it right in the beginning of the interview, and that it's a much more dangerous place. And I just wanted to give you the opportunity to discuss that, because I think for my generation, who was maybe in college at that point, you know, hitting maybe their 20s. It's kind of become the norm. And for those generations that, that are now growing up, this is the norm. But for this the activities that we're now dealing with, it's certainly very different, and the threats we face.
Well, yeah, technology has affected a couple of things. One is the scale of the lethality. Let's call it lethality, how lethal an attack can be. And the deliverability of threats. And for a long time, most of the nation's history, a threat to be delivered to the United States had to somehow had to cross the oceans, and we had this sort of insulation. But with air travel being what it is, and being the ability to use the fuel in an airplane as the explosive capacity of a weapon, the airplane becomes a weapon, and individuals who are traveling can, well, they did. They invaded the country. They got in legally, but they overstayed their visas and things like that, so they were technically illegally here at the time, and they commandeered these airplanes. And now things are even much more lethal than they. So you had this coefficient of lethality, if you will, the idea of how lethal modernity is and the deliverability of it. Those two things have really elevated. And that's not to mention the potential of which we were very quickly aware of, the potential of evil chemistry or evil biology, that to have biological weapons or chemical weapons that could also be used, transmitted and delivered in ways that would be very threatening.
Let me ask this last one, General Ashcroft, and that is you're still teaching students and you're teaching national security. The issue that we have faced and continue to face has not gone away. In fact, it's, as you said, more complicated. What is the message you're communicating to these students?
Well, in terms of national security, is that really the security of the nation is too important to leave to a few government agencies alone. That our ability to thwart attacks and to be a safe culture requires the sort of alertness of all citizens. And that, as we have deferred threats that have happened since 9/11, it has been with the cooperation of citizens, whether it was the shoe bombers or the people in the Times Square in New York or the variety of other settings. And it requires a cooperation. It's not something that can be undertaken by a few people. And the last point I would make is that prior to 9/11, you could almost assure the security of the United States by dealing with resources inside the United States.
Yep.
But you have to be able to be aware of trends and be aware of activities of people both planning and resourcing and developing threats against the United States that are now being assembled outside the United States but could be delivered here, imposed here, and could cause great difficulty here.
Former U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft, thank you for being with us, and thank you for your insight. Thank you for your leadership during those trying times.
Well, Jay and Jordan, I'm delighted to be with you, and I'm grateful for what you do to help our culture be aware of what each citizen has as a responsibility for a safe America.
Thank you, General Ashcroft. All right, we're going to be back. If you don't get the full hour of the broadcast, remember, just go over to ACLJ.org or Facebook or Periscope. You get it there. A lot of your stations are not carrying the full hour, which is great. We'll be back with more, including calls if you want to talk to us, 1-800-684-3110. And a lot of good comments coming by Facebook as well.
This is a critical time for the Supreme Court and our nation. President Trump has nominated a brilliant jurist. Judge Brett Kavanaugh is eminently qualified. The American Center for Law and Justice is mobilizing on Capitol Hill, demanding Judge Kavanaugh's immediate confirmation. Sign on to our petition, calling on the U.S. Senate to confirm Judge Kavanaugh without delay. Add your name to our petition right now online, ACLJ.org.
Live from Washington, D.C., Jay Sekulow Live.
Faith, hope, and love are some good things He gave us, and the greatest is love.
I can hear you!
And now, Chief Counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice, Jay Sekulow.
17 years ago today that the World Trade Centers were attacked. In fact, as you're listening to this broadcast, those World Trade Centers were already on the ground in rubble. Let me give you the time frame on this. I think it's important. We'll be joined by our full team here to discuss this. 8:46 a.m., hijacked Flight 11 crashed into floors 93 and 99, the North Tower, One World Trade Center. My grandfather, by the way, Jordan's great-grandfather, was the chief electrician on the World Trade Centers back in the 60s, Grandpa Murray. At 9:03 a.m., the hijacked Flight 175 struck floors 77 through 85 of the South Tower. 17 minutes later, that was 17 minutes after the first attack. At the time the towers were struck, between 16,400 people and 18,000 people were in the World Trade Center complex. At 9:37, just less than an hour later, five hijackers crashed American Flight 77 into the Pentagon. 53 passengers and six crew were among the 125 military and civilian personnel killed. At 9:59, South Tower collapses. At 10:03 a.m., Flight 93 crashes near Shanksville, Pennsylvania. At 10:28, North Tower collapses of the World Trade Center. On May 2, 2011, in the evening, we were informed by President Obama that Osama bin Laden was killed in Pakistan by SEAL Team 6. So there we are. Now, we are going to talk about where we are now and what this has meant, but we also want reflection. Than Bennett is our Director of Governmental Affairs, but before that, he was a staffer, as a young staffer, at a Congressman Ryan's office in out of Kansas. And Than, you were, tell everybody what you were doing. That Jordan gave his what he was doing while he was in school. What were you doing?
Yeah, that timeline brings back a rush of memories, Jay, because I was in the Capitol complex that day, much like I was this morning, actually. I was working just across the street from the United States Capitol in the Cannon House office building for a member of Congress. And Jay, when that first plane hit the first tower, I think many of us still thought it was an accident, but a lot of us were watching the news coverage. And when the plane hit the South Tower a few minutes later, much like the rest of town, Jay, we knew instantly we were at war. But the thing I remember most about that day was a few minutes later, as the Capitol Police were rushing through the complex, evacuating everyone. Initially, Jay, it was sort of a calm evacuation. People were walking. It sort of felt like a drill. And then the Capitol Police started running through the halls saying, "The planes are in the air. Don't walk. Run." And I just remember, especially in hindsight now, you look back, the planes that were in the air, Jay, those were the ones that were headed towards Washington, D.C., where Jordan and I were at. One, of course, hit the Pentagon. The other one was speculating to be heading for the Capitol complex. So as you walk through that timeline, as a very young staffer on the House side, it's sort of surreal how similar it was today. But in that moment, in that evacuation moment, that's when it became very real just how serious it was.
Jordan, do you remember, you were, what, 19 years old, I guess, at the time, right? Do you remember when we drove back from Richmond to Washington, D.C., and when we got to the apartment, what the streets of Washington were like?
A militarized zone and empty. So, I mean, it was, and this went on for a long period of time. School came back pretty quickly. I think it was within 24 hours that because they had to deal with some people were on campus. They were stuck in the city for the most part. And most of GW is coming up from the Northeast, New York, New Jersey. So people were not going back there. Ultimately, I mean, we had Humvees on the street corners and anti-aircraft on top of those Humvees and military in the streets. And so it was a very real sense that this attack was still ongoing.
Yes.
So remember I was also interned at Department of Justice, and that kept getting evacuated.
We'll talk about that
constantly. It was not – and then I think that you think about now that it's almost – it's 7 years since Osama bin Laden was killed.
I know.
I mean, so even that moment,
you remember
moment, and those college students who came out of the streets to celebrate that in 2011 were also children when those attacks occurred. Remember that White House scene that we saw that night? It was 11:35 at night when President Obama announced that. Those were people who were barely born on the day that attack occurred.
Do you remember the – I only got 20 seconds here. Do you remember going to the restaurant and walking by those Humvees with those
– Yep.
We were the very few people in the city. Boy, remember the Pentagon was still – from the apartment you lived in, you could see the smoke of the Pentagon.
Yeah. I mean, it was a very serious time.
Yep. All right, when we come back, we'll take your calls, 800-684-3110, 1-800-684-3110.
This is a critical time for the Supreme Court and our nation. President Trump has nominated a brilliant jurist to fill the seat created by the retirement of Justice Kennedy. Judge Brett Kavanaugh is eminently qualified. He has extensive experience and a commitment to adhere to the rule of law and uphold the Constitution. Yet the radical left is pulling out all the stops to derail this nomination. That's why it's so critical to support this nominee. The American Center for Law and Justice is mobilizing on Capitol Hill, demanding Judge Kavanaugh's immediate confirmation. Stand with us on this critical fight. Sign on to our petition, calling on the U.S. Senate to confirm Judge Kavanaugh without delay. Add your name to our petition right now online, aclj.org. It's a historic move. Now the United States has moved its embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, Israel's true capital. The state of Israel and its very right to exist is a linchpin issue not only in the Middle East, but represents a critical issue to the world at large. Israel is facing unprecedented challenges. Enemies abound. ISIS, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran all pledge to wipe Israel from the face of the earth. In his new book, New York Times bestselling author Jay Sekulow presents a powerful political and historical rationale for the existence of Israel as a sovereign nation. Jerusalem, a biblical and historical case for the Jewish capital, presents clear, irrefutable evidence to remove any doubt about Israel's right to exist. And the book dispels legal myths purported by Israel's enemies. Get your copy today, Jerusalem, a Biblical and Historical Case for the Jewish Capital. Available now at Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Well, we talked to Than Bennett. Jordan talked about his recollection of what it was like in Washington, D.C. when right after 9/11 as it took place. I remember the scurrying around when the plane was on the way into the Pentagon. I was driving up from Norfolk to Richmond to meet Jordan at that point. Wes Smith is a colonel in the United States Army, retired now, but at the time, Wes, let's talk about what was going on in your life. You had just retired.
Yeah, I just left active duty. I spent 12 years on active duty. I was a young major. I missed being a parish priest, and so I had taken a position in Kansas, in Topeka, as the rector, which is Episcopal speak for the senior priest at a parish, and was on the way to a clergy meeting when all this happened. And I don't think anyone understood the long-term impact of it in that moment. Now, 17 years later, it's still seared into the collective conscience of America. But at the time, I did not know, because in about 8 weeks, I received orders that I was being called back to active duty, and that began a long saga of service in the military and ultimately retiring in 2013. So it changed my life, changes that I would not trade for anything now. But it's still, for every American, it's seared into our memories. We remember exactly where we were, what we were doing, and it's a small piece of the narrative, but it's my personal piece. That's how I ended up being called back to active duty.
You know, it's an interesting thing, Jordan. You mentioned that, was it 5 million?
5.5 million. 5.5 million people volunteered to join the U.S. military since
9/11. And then, as you said, two wars. Yes.
Two wars.
And
the war still goes on. The war on terror is a multi-generational war.
And but I want to go back to one of your duties and responsibilities. Yeah. You were at Dover.
Yeah, I was assigned to the Pentagon to revamp their casualty notification procedures because they had not been updated in years and years and years. And so they brought me back on active duty to do that, and then ultimately sent me to Dover because most of the casualties were Army casualties during those two wars, and I was an Army chaplain. I became the senior ranking chaplain at Dover, where my job was to do the ramp ceremonies for bodies as they came in from Iraq and Afghanistan, and then to sit down and talk with each of the families, because we began at government expense flying families to Dover. We thought only a few would want to come. 85% of the families who lost loved ones showed up at Dover, and so it was a very touching and meaningful few years there in my last years in the Army.
Yeah. Harry, as our director of policy, how do you view now, 17 years later, how do you view the situation?
Well, it's a difficult situation, but first I would say that heroism has multiplied in the face of evil. So Americans have responded to terror. So in addition to the thousands of precious human lives lost on 9/11, some because people jumped from the towers, 9/11 has left an indelible impact on the United States. Since 9/11, as Jordan correctly points out, 5.5 million men and women have responded by enlisting in the military. The military and the Department of Homeland Security have spent over $2.8 trillion, roughly $190 billion per year since 9/11. But the war continues. But in the face of 9/11, we should note America has changed forever. The world has changed forever. A terror is now a global phenomena, and eternal vigilance is necessary.
And what you
the thing I used to think about during my time at Dover, too, is that we have an all-volunteer military force. No one's drafted. No one has to join. And I'd be out on that flight line praying and doing the ceremonies and then talking with the families, and it would occur to me over and over that it's an all-volunteer force. These young men and women, by the tens and hundreds of thousands during the last 17 years, volunteered. Made them go to war. And yet, in spite of all the casualties, and over 6,000 U.S. troops have died in this war, those young men and women kept raising their right hand and said, send me. And it made me incredibly proud of this generation of Americans.
Yeah, let's go ahead. We're going to take some phone calls. 1-800-684-3110, 800-684-3110.
Yeah, let's go to Sandy in Norfolk, Virginia, on line one. Sandy, welcome to JSEC, you're live.
Hi, Sandy. I was in Norfolk, Virginia when 9/11 took place at Regent University. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I heard that. I want to thank you first for doing this remembrance. But I'd like to say that that day I was watching television, and when I first saw it, I thought it was a movie trailer.
Yeah.
And then when I realized it was real, I couldn't believe what I was seeing.
Yeah.
And to this day, I remember the rest of the morning, the devastation. I couldn't go to work. And to this day, it still upsets me. And I remember the devastation that happened. And I said, oh, my God, what is happening to us?
Well, when you saw the devastation I think the thing is just seared in my memory, and that is that when you saw the people jumping out of the towers, mm-hmm. Even today it's a moment you don't forget. And I think we do a disservice to the country if we forget this. And we're not going to do that. We made a promise when this happened, 9/11, that every year that there was every year that went forward that we were on the air, we were going to never let a time go by when we were on air that day, that we were not going to, we would discuss it, period. Andy, looking at it forward, but also back, I mean, you're a historian. I mean, unfortunately, Rudy Giuliani said this, so did General Ashcroft. This is in Jordan. It's intergenerational here. This conflict is multi-generational and intergenerational at the same time.
That's true, Jay. We have been, the significance of 7, I think, comes in. And you know I like to play with numbers and the significance of those. This is 17 years. But when you look back to the 7th century, we have been fighting jihadist and radical Islam since the 7th century, when the West was threatened by the rise of Islam and radical terrorist organizations such as those that precipitated and were behind the devastation that occurred in New York City. So that's the thing that we have to guard against, is never lose the vigilance that we have to lose in fighting against the enemies of the United States. Yeah.
Let's go ahead and take another phone call. If you want to talk to us, 1-800-684-3110. That's 800-684-3110.
Kurt is calling in from Dallas, Texas, online too. Kurt, welcome to JSEC You Live.
Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jay. Thank you. Everything that you do for our country on a legal basis, I truly appreciate it.
Yep.
Let me give those kudos to you. First-time caller, I remember everything exactly on 9/11, and I'm getting goosebumps now.
Yep.
I was working on a trading desk as a programmer at Duke Energy in Houston at the time, and I remember walking in there, and I see the second plane hitting the second building, and I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, what is going on?
Yep.
And what the lady said, Sandy, before, about we were talking about the bodies falling out. Could you imagine having to make a decision?
No.
Whether to be burned alive or to fall out the buildings. My other thoughts are, I got to see the movie Flight 93 several times.
Yep.
Those were some truly remarkable brave
yes, they were.
Men and women that they said, get
Patriots.
Us the forks, get us a knife, make a call to your loved ones, let's get ready, let's get prepared, because they knew that if they didn't storm that cockpit, things would have been unwell. And if you study the history of all those men, I forget where the article was, on Slate or something, which is a liberal left, entity, but they said they messed with the wrong people on that plane that day. Every one of those people were very, very highly successful, motivated, and did very well in life. So to me, that was a God
Well, you know, the president talked, and again, we're not making this political, but I thought the president's words today were very moving and very meaningful about Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Take a listen to 21.
This field is now a monument to American defiance. This memorial is now a message to the world. America will never, ever submit to tyranny.
Van, you're in Washington right now, and just the kind of the thoughts about that statement. I thought the president's statements were very strong. I thought, look, the President Bush's reassuring moment. Wes, you said that was he became president that day on September 11th in one sense. And there are these moments in a presidency where are defining moments. And this was one, though, defining for our country.
Yeah, I mean, President Trump was spot on today. President Bush, Jay, I think history is reflecting and will continue to reflect on his leadership in a way that is overwhelmingly positive and that really saved the nation a lot of harm going forward. Look, I would reflect on Kurt's call right here right now. There's no greater love than someone who gives down or lays down their life for another. And then the people on Flight 93, Jay,
they did it.
There is just no other way to say it than they laid down their lives for those of us in the city that I am sitting in, the city that I was in on that day. And when we say never forget, there are a lot of things we don't want to forget. We don't want to forget the victims. We don't want to forget those heroes on that flight. And Jay, we also have to make sure that we don't forget when it comes to U.S. policy, because the resolve of the enemy is very patient. It's very long. And our resolve, to Jordan's intergenerational point, Jay, those that did not walk through this can't forget as well, because this war is ongoing and we have to outlast the patience of the enemy.
You remember, I mean, I know you do, Jordan, that of course, just a week or two later, we had the whole anthrax thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this was not over in a day. And it was everything changed. The whole security, what we do at airports, what we have to submit. I mean, we now have facial recognition starting in Washington, D.C. airports. I mean, that has been introduced as to the last 24 hours. And this is all new. This is all because of what happened that day, that everything changed. Travel all around the world, and what it meant to be an American changed also, because we were the target of the attack, specifically the United States.
All right, we're going to come back. Last segment of the broadcast, we'll take your calls, 1-800-684-3110, 800-684-3110. Back with more in just a moment.
It's a historic move. Now the United States has moved its embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, Israel's true capital. The state of Israel and its very right to exist is a linchpin issue not only in the Middle East, but represents a critical issue to the world at large. Israel is facing unprecedented challenges. Enemies abound. ISIS, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran all pledge to wipe Israel from the face of the earth. In his new book, New York Times bestselling author Jay Sekulow presents a powerful political and historical rationale for the existence of Israel as a sovereign nation. Jerusalem, a biblical and historical case for the Jewish capital, presents clear, irrefutable evidence to remove any doubt about Israel's right to exist. And the book dispels legal myths purported by Israel's enemies. Get your copy today, Jerusalem, a Biblical and Historical Case for the Jewish Capital. Available now at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. This is a critical time for the Supreme Court and our nation. President Trump has nominated a brilliant jurist to fill the seat created by the retirement of Justice Kennedy. Judge Brett Kavanaugh is eminently qualified. He has extensive experience and a commitment to adhere to the rule of law and uphold the Constitution. Yet the radical left is pulling out all the stops to derail this nomination. That's why it's so critical to support this nominee. The American Center for Law and Justice is mobilizing on Capitol Hill, demanding Judge Kavanaugh's immediate confirmation. Stand with us on this critical fight. Sign on to our petition, calling on the U.S. Senate to confirm Judge Kavanaugh without delay. Add your name to our petition right now online, aclj.org.
Colonel Wes Smith on our team just during the break was sharing with us while we were playing. That probably we're going to play the Lee Greenwood, God Bless the USA, at the end of the broadcast. Wes, you brought up a really important, interesting point about the Pentagon.
Yeah, and most people don't realize this. First of all, the point of impact of the plane was a ring of the Pentagon that had just been remodeled, and they were just moving back into it. Otherwise, the casualties would have been a lot higher because the Pentagon is a huge place. A lot of people work in that ring. That ring was the designated new offices for the Army Chief Chaplains and all of his staff. They were supposed to move into that office the week before. They had delayed it until the afternoon of September the 11th. Mm. Therefore, the Army Chief of Chaplains' entire staff was spared because they had not yet moved in. But what I was sharing during their break was, say what you will, America is a spiritual nation, and most Americans at some level are people of faith. Following the events of that day, as they went back and rebuilt that ring of the Pentagon, the brass at the Pentagon, the senior leadership, on purpose, put the Pentagon Chapel at the point of impact. If you go to the Pentagon today, the Pentagon Chapel is at the exact spot where that plane entered the building, because that's part of who we are as Americans as well.
All right, let's go ahead and go back to the phones. 1-800-684-3110.
Yeah, let's go to Naomi in Colorado online too. Naomi, welcome to Jay Sekulow Live.
Hi, Naomi.
Hello.
Yep.
It was such a different world before all of 9/11 happened, to the point that our daughter was applying to the Air Force Academy. She was allowed to enter. We put her in June, and then 3 months later, we're paralyzed with this vision of what happened that day. Can't get a hold of her. And since then, she's deployed many times to different places, and she's lieutenant colonel now, but continues to serve. But it was not the same world, and it's just so radically changed. I hate to go through an airport anymore.
I know that, but listen, first of all, thank you for your daughter's service. This is exactly what Jordan was talking about. You got a generation of young people. Jordan was 19 years old. Your daughter was probably 18 years old. It really has, impact. It's a whole different generation and approach on this.
Yeah, and it's all continuing. So I think that when Osama bin Laden was killed, that reinforced it again to also the next generation, because they learn about it maybe in school, maybe not even born yet, or were just young children, weren't even knowing what was on TV.
Yep.
And then they go through that experience. Well, who is this? Why is this important? It was a decade.
Yeah.
So it was a decade hunting the organizer of this.
Yep.
And ultimately, I think that reinforces. And then now we get close to a 20th anniversary,
which would be another whole thing. Yep.
Yeah. So it's changed everything for our lives to a point where I don't really remember I don't remember an airport before that. I mean, I know the stories of an airport before that, but you don't really remember, because it's so enforced on you to have your ID, to have your all the information available to you to get through all these different steps, and basically take off your shoes, take off your belt. That is all. And now we're getting hopefully to a point where it makes it easier again with this facial recognition, that will
change the
clear us through again, so that we don't have to maybe go through all of these step by step. But always the plane, always the same. I don't think it will ever be the same on that. People are not going to let that happen.
Yep.
Voluntarily, there will always be a fight. There's always going to be that Flight 93 scenario, and we've seen that. So I think the terrorists will always try to use the planes, because, as General Ashcroft said, it's a flying weapon if you can take over. But I think also that the people on the plane are not going to let that go down without a fight.
Well, there's a different, completely different Andy mentality now. There's a. I think what Jordan says is right. There's a pre-9/11 mentality and a post-9/11 mentality.
Yes. Well, I lived through both. I mean, I remember the morning I was in Atlanta driving to work. I remember my car. I remember being on Jackson Street in Atlanta going to the Hurt Building. So you remember those things. The only other thing that I remember with that kind of acuity is the assassination of President Kennedy.
Yeah.
When I was 15 years old, and those kinds of events are earth-shattering and mind-changing. The world was not the same with us after President Kennedy's assassination, because we revered him as a young, vigorous president, and the same thing here, a nation that was shocked by radical Islam. You know, a Greek Orthodox church, Jay, was destroyed in 9/11. It's just now being rebuilt 17 years later and hasn't yet been completed, but the only church that was destroyed was a Greek Orthodox church, St. Nicholas, in New York City. Those are the events that we remember.
Yep. Harry, what's your recollection or reflection on all this?
Well, my recollection was sitting on the couch watching the first plane hit the tower, thinking, well, maybe it's an accident.
Yep.
But then when I saw the second plane hit the second tower, I knew it was a planned, premeditated event. And so now Shanksville, Pennsylvania, the World Trade Center site, and the Pentagon have become monuments to American resilience in the face of terror. We have responded as a nation. We have responded as individuals. And we will no longer remain silent in the face of evil.
All right.
Back to the phones. Linda in Arizona, online one. Linda, welcome to JSEC You're Live.
Hi, Linda.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call, Jay. I was in Houston at the time. Excuse me. I lived there for quite a while, 20-some-odd years. And that day changed the way the downtown Houston area did business. The police officers immediately, I was in one of the large buildings, and they evacuated us so quickly and told us to get out of downtown. But what I remember is no planes.
Yep.
There was no planes flying.
Right. They were grounded.
A week or so. Mm-hmm. And then when we went back to work, I think it was about 10 days later, everyone had to show their ID. They had to prove that they worked in the building. We all had badges waiting for us.
Yep.
It was very solemn, and I think that's, if you go downtown, you have to know someone before you can get up into the building.
Yeah, no, so, I think, look, the whole world of, I think what Jordan said is right. There's a pre-9/11 way we lived, and there's a post-9/11 way we lived. And the technology may get better to make it a little bit more easy to cope with, but it's never going to go back. It's just the nature of what that kind of attack on a homeland meant. Let's try to grab the last call.
Yeah, Linda in New York, online five. Linda, welcome to JSEC You're Live.
Hi, Linda.
Hi. I don't really have a question. I just watched the memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where Flight 93 crashed, and President Trump was very inspiring. But the courageous 40 people that gave their lives to save other people's lives, it just, I couldn't stop crying. It was just,
it was a great, I will say this, and I said I don't want to get political, but the president gave a great speech. And this one I'm going to play right now is one of the best, I think the best parts of it.
We're gathered together on these hallowed grounds to honor the memory of nearly 3,000 souls who were murdered on this day 17 years ago. We're here to pay solemn tribute to the 40 passengers and crew members on Flight 93 who rose up, defied the enemy, took control of their destiny, and changed the course of history.
And you know, they really did change the course of history. That plane was destined for the Capitol building. I mean, Than, I know you think about that. That's where that plane was.
Absolutely. I said it earlier, Jay, no greater love. They laid down their lives for another citizen.
For you.
This citizen's eternally grateful. President Trump is right. Those are the real heroes of that day, among others, of course.
Yeah, but it's an amazing thing when you think about that. I mean, that Flight 93, and I know there's been movies and all that's great, but what a heroic move. Of course, all of it was. Everybody that, all the first response, how about running up a building that's going to collapse to get Americans out? Well, that's going to do it for the broadcast today, as we wanted to make this a day of remembrance and a day of honor to the men and women that are also serving our country now and defending our freedom, so we can come to you each and every day on this broadcast. So you don't want to forget them. Tomorrow we'll talk about the news. Today I want to reflect on 9/11. That's what we did. For those on Facebook and Periscope, we encourage you to share it with your friends. We have a special music tribute, our band with Lee Greenwood and the song God Bless the USA.
This is a critical time for the Supreme Court and our nation. President Trump has nominated a brilliant jurist. Judge Brett Kavanaugh is eminently qualified. The American Center for Law and Justice is mobilizing on Capitol Hill, demanding Judge Kavanaugh's immediate confirmation. Sign on to our petition, calling on the U.S. Senate to confirm Judge Kavanaugh without delay. Add your name to our petition right now online, ACLJ.